Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. This was a long time coming. I have known Stephen T. Siegel for many, many years, and there's a bit of a Chicago connection, which is always great. I don't know. It just... You look up and all of a sudden it's been years and it's like, God, I still haven't had a conversation with Steve. Well, a couple months ago, I was interviewing Shelley Bond and Diana Schutz, and Steve was edited by both and happened to come on the chat. It's always a great compliment when comic book business people are watching Word Balloon, as well as, the rest of you that also watch that are fans like me. But this really meant a lot. So I'm like, Steve, let's do a talk. So here we are. Great conversation. We cover a lot of the old stuff. Steve teases some new projects that he has going on. Of course, he's one of the Man of Action production team, the original creators of Man of Action, which is a great idea laboratory with very creative people and some of our favorite creators of comics. We talk about Man of Action and the things they've done. We talk about the writer's strike. Got to talk about that. Steve is a WGA member, and I appreciate his point of view on all of that. And, of course, we got to talk about Sandman Mystery Theater. That is really my favorite licensed property that Steve's ever had his hands on. I like his creator-owned stuff. We certainly get into that as well. But I am a sucker for Sandman Mystery Theater. Him, Matt Wagner, Guy Davis, the rest of the crew. An incredible run. And really, the after a million world or universe-ending events, when they decided in the 90s that Superman, the Golden Age Superman, was not part of DC's beginnings, it was left to a lot of the mystery men that were around before the superheroes. People like Dr. Occult and Slam Bradley and Wesley Dodds, who, yeah, became the Sandman, but was a very different hero in his original incarnation before going the full superhero tights route. And I had to ask him about that and the creation of it and the plotting and all of it. So lots to talk about regarding Sandman Mystery Theater. And I appreciated Steve indulging me on that subject. Also, great questions from the crowd as well, and I really appreciate that. Stephen T. Siegel on today's Word Balloon. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Pulse College. Pulse College has three decades of a proven track record delivering professional industry training courses in audio, music, film, games, and animation. Since 1991, Pulse has received international recognition for both its vocational and practical-driven academic courses. All courses are designed and delivered by experienced industry professionals and offer cutting-edge blends of academic perspectives fused with practical skill sets in the areas of film, music, games, and animation. This, combined with the unique teaching and learning environment of the iconic Windmill Lane Recording Studios, makes world-class industry education attainable. Learners from around the world can join in a variety of short courses offered remotely via Zoom in the fields of sequential art and design, 2D animation, 3D animation, character design, and game environments. For more details, visit pulsecollege.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress with an important plea for 2023. You probably read the headlines. Word Balloon took a sponsorship hit that was pretty significant, and I'm asking you if you've ever been a fan of Word Balloon and considered making a donation through Patreon, a very meager but important subscription. I hope you'll consider it. It's going to be a challenging 2023, and I need your help. So if you like Word Balloon, if you enjoy the content, I'm not going to slow down and keep bringing you some excellent content, but I could really use your help via Patreon, patreon.com/wordballoon. If you can afford the price of a comic book, if you can even afford $1 a month, it would be greatly appreciated and help the cause to keep Word Balloon going at the level and intensity that I've been doing in the last 4 or 5 years, and bring you a lot more content and a lot of great interviews and interesting things about the pop culture world. Patreon.com/wordballoon. I could really use your help. Thank you for your attention, your time, and listening to Word Balloon. Word Balloon is brought to you by AlexRossArt.com. Alex has been a longtime sponsor of Word Balloon. I greatly appreciate it. You got to go to his website. You will find tremendous art from original work, covers, pages, fantastic lithographs, amazing posters. Every price point is covered, and every subject is covered at alexrossart.com. You've enjoyed his iconic looks at DC and Marvel, but also great stuff like his wonderful work on The Monkees, Monty Python, so many other great pop culture things that Alex has put his fingerprints on. His wonderful Flash Gordon poster that evokes the fantastic Dino De Laurentiis, Sam Jones movie. Recently, Alex did things like the timeless Marvel covers featuring great solo shots of all your favorite Marvel heroes. And, of course, his Fantastic Four full circle graphic novel still available. All waiting for you now at alexrossart.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. Long time coming talking to this guy, a Chicago guy that I got to meet a few times at conventions. And I'm so glad to finally have him on Word Balloon. It's Stephen T. Siegel. Welcome,
Stephen. I love that I get status as a Chicago guy. I'm actually not. My wife is a Chicago guy, actually a Chicago gal. And that's kind of how I met you. But
yes.
But I love Chicago. I loved Star of Siam. I would eat there all the time. I lived in Indiana.
Yes.
Next door. So if you live in Indiana, at least when I did in the 90s, you had to go to Chicago for something to happen to you. So that's what I did.
That's cool, man. I will tell the quick story that, yeah, you know, back when I was working in radio in the 90s at the rock station WXRT and the sports station The Score, our mutual good friend Susan Ferrara is like, hey, this teacher friend of mine really wants us to come over and talk to her class about radio. And I'm like, all right. And so I go, and it was me, Susan, and my friend Tom Couch, who was the guy who made the commercials at both stations. And we get there, and Steven's partner, Liesl, is wearing this really cool kind of baseball jersey sort of DC jacket.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Liesl, where'd you get that? That's fantastic. And she's like, and of course, you know, this was a long time ago. She's like, oh, my boyfriend, you know, Steve and everything. And she's like, you know, he writes Steven Siegel. And I'm like, I know Steve Siegel. I love his comics. That's fantastic, man. And then a couple of years later, we finally met face to face in San Diego.
Yeah. So it's either a small world or the Matrix is really out of memory and just has to reuse people over and over again. That's why I'm your guest now.
Dude, it's outstanding. And I'm really glad to talk to you. Weird timing, I guess, with the WGA strike. Of course, Steve, Joe Casey, Joe Kelly, and Duncan. And how do I say Duncan's last name?
Rulo. Duncan he is Rulo. The Chicago guy, by the way.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, okay. We did a voice thing for one of our cartoons, Generator Rex, and he had to say the word jetpack, and he kept saying jetpack. And they're like, where are you from, Chicago? And he's like, yeah. So
that's outstanding. Well, the four of you guys were smart years and years ago after making your marketing comics and up in your game and creating Man of Action, the wonderful production company that, good Lord, I mean, I'll pop up images, but we're talking about great stuff like Ben 10 and Hero 6 and a couple Marvel animated shows along the way and Generator. Generator, pardon me, man. Yeah. Say this is where the former Saturday morning cartoon guy might slip every now and then. But no,
that's,
man,
all good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really, well done to all of you. I've talked to Kelly and Casey, the Joes, and everything about it as well. But yeah, man, it's like really well done, truly.
Well, it wasn't intentional. I mean, let's get that out of the way. We didn't go, let's conquer the world by making a company together. We literally got tired of how big San Diego Comic-Con was getting and wanted to sit down and watch it move by us instead of us moving by it. And so Joe Casey or Joe Kelly, one of the Joes, was like, let's just get a booth. So I was like, all right. And I went over and I said, we want a booth. And they're like, well, what's your company name? I'm like, hang on. And I talk to the guys. I'm like, we have to have a company name. And Joe Kelly's like, okay, we're Evil Geniuses. I'm like, okay. So I went back. I'm like, we're Evil Geniuses. They're like, flip, flip, flip. Nope, we've got that. I'm like, hang on. I went back. Joe Kelly's like, Man of Action. I'm like, all right. I went back. I'm like, we're Man of Action. They're like, flip, flip, flip. Okay, we don't have that. So that's literally how we became a company, was wanting to sit down at San Diego and have some place to put all of our books and comics under the table as we bought them instead of carrying them around. And while we were sitting there, the first 3 years we did that, people came up each year and hired us to do jobs because they thought we were a company. And then we would get like paid a check that we could not cash because we were not a company and didn't have a bank account. And so like the first year when that happened, we took this job, did it. I was like, well, I guess I'll go open a bank account. And I went to the business bank and they're like, well, but where's your operating agreement and your business license? I'm like, hang on. And, you know, we became a business by default to cash checks that we got by default because people thought we were a company because we had a table at San Diego.
That's wonderful. All of that is wonderful.
It turned out okay, but planning, no.
Let's get some WGA stuff out of the way. You know, we're in the midst of the writer's strike. I've been talking a lot with writers and also writers that are producers as well. And I don't even know right now if you've got any active animation or live action. I mean, mostly obviously you're known for animation, but first of all, yeah. I mean, so are you on like a weird standing because you guys are writers, but also producers?
No, I mean, we've all been or are in the Writers Guild currently, and we've done live action stuff that obviously would be completely off the table. Animation is covered by the guild only if it's kind of what used to be called primetime series animation. Nowadays, what does that even mean?
Right.
And the spaces that we create for primarily are kids' spaces. We have some other stuff that, you know, that we are not working on at the moment. But the kids stuff, we had to talk to our lawyers and our managers and just say what's off limits and what's not. We're not working on anything that's off limits. And if somebody is, you know, a struck company, we're not going to cross any picket lines to work on stuff. So most of what we're working on is fine. If it wasn't, we wouldn't do it. And we're in solidarity with writers because we're in the guild. So, yes.
Yeah. No, I hear you, man. You know, honestly, the Radio and Television Guild merged with the Screen Actors Guild. So, and we just, you know, authorized to strike earlier. Was it earlier this week or last week? I can't remember.
Last week, yeah.
It was last week. Thank you. The end of last week. And you know, I voted to strike. I stand with the writers as well and know how important and valuable writers are. And I mean, it's so basic. There was a knucklehead on Twitter that's like, well, you know, a lot of TV shows and movies suck, so they shouldn't get more money. And it's like, that's not what it's about.
That's never what it's about. Well, I mean, the main thing with all of this stuff is that there's always enough money to meet these demands. It's just for whatever reason, the not Hollywood, but the model of business is, will you come up with everything and then give it to me for nothing so I can make everything off of it? Yep. And the answer is no. But for my entire lifetime, it's been like, but I'll do it for very little and you can have everything else, which they're fine with. And then when you go, you know what? My very little is too little. I need a little more. They're like, you're killing me. Which is not true. And so we do this little dance and it's designed to make sure that they don't give any more than they have to. And then we move along. We're also executive producers of all of our shows.
Right.
So I do understand the other side. There are economic factors that go into all of this stuff, but the basic truth is that there's a lot more money on the producerial side that could go to some of this stuff without breaking the bank or bankrupting anybody.
Agreed. I mean, it really is that basic. And God, I mean, honestly, Chris Cantwell, Mark Guggenheim have been recent guests that have, you know, kind of explained things. And truly, man, no, like you said, it really has gone from, okay, we're going to pitch you, but if you want to develop it and stuff, give us money. And now it's like, no, you got to really give us a lot, not just the concept, but maybe in a couple episodes and things like that. And
when I started, because I've had some live action stuff in Hollywood, sure. Most of it not produced, but you used to be able to make a living off of that even. But you could pitch, I sold a TV show to Fox back in the day that I went into a room and I pitched an idea. Like that wasn't even very well thought out. And they're like, we want to be in business with you. And they bought it in the room. And then I had to go write it. Like I had to figure all of it out after that. You know, I had very little. Now, if I go in to pitch something, they want to have a script to read, maybe two. They want it cast. They want to know who's directing it. Like they want everything done and delivered. If you would make the show so they could watch it first and then decide, which some people do, like there are people who do things that are bought on acquisition, that would be even better. How much risk can they offset to you so that they don't take the risk? And again, from a producerial standpoint, that makes perfect sense. But from a creative standpoint, who can afford to do that?
Exactly, man. Literally, the writers can't even make a middle class income. And Guggenheim said it best a couple episodes ago, where he said, you know, all we're asking for is like, you know, kind of a middle-class wage, and writing shouldn't be a side hustle or where you need to Uber drive or wait tables or whatever while you're getting stuff made. And it's kind of crazy.
Yep, it is. Yeah. It is crazy. I mean, there's some stuff they're doing better. I think representation has been a big issue, and they're quick to move on that because it doesn't really cost them anything. So if it's an issue that doesn't have an economic underline per se, hallelujah. But if you're going, you know what, we need a little more money in the retirement fund, and if you're going to use AI, you have to compensate us, and you're making us do the work of 12 people that used to be the work of 3 people that used to be done by 12. So that should have an economic offset. As soon as there's money, it's like, we can't do that. Well, they can, they don't want to.
I'm hip. Absolutely. God, I wonder, really, I'm not going to San Diego this year. I can only imagine what it's likely going to look like if this continues. It's 5 weeks away. And I don't know, you know, God, and I didn't even know the Directors Guild got all their demands. And
they,
it's like,
they did, but they had a very different set of demands. And there are far fewer people in the Directors Guild.
Sure.
It's economically, it's not quite the same offset. Okay. I believe I'm just talking out of my ass. I have no idea if that's true or not, but I think it's true. I'm going to say it's true for now, and then I can be disproven in the comments, I'm sure.
Attaboy.
But they also didn't have quite the same take on AI that we have, which is another big issue. You know, it's like ChatGPT can already write an ad that's not bad. You know, it can write business copy for things. It's not bad. And it's just going to be minutes before you put in, you know, a few terms, and it spits out an action movie that's not bad, which in and of itself is, you know, it's creepy, but that's technology.
Yeah.
However, what's going to happen is a screenwriter who used to get 7 figures to write an action movie is going to be told, here's the action movie, polish it for $25,000. And somebody's going to say yes. And then that's going to be the going rate for writers.
Good Lord.
So that's a big issue that's being negotiated as well.
You know, and I've heard this from previous comic writers and artists before that of earlier generations than us. But did you see something not similar in terms of mechanics, but really pure economics in comics, where maybe you were getting a certain page rate or a certain, you know, script rate or whatever, and then all of a sudden, as you know, and as your example with television and film writing, that, you know, there's always another writer that's going to be willing to do the job for less money because they want to break in. I don't know if you experienced anything like that.
It's, you know, it's not just comics. A lot of businesses
Sure. Read
about it. It's, again, the person with all the money wants the rest of it. And so they go down to lowest common, not denominator, but person willing to take the least money. Yeah. When I started in comics, I started at Renegade Press, Denny Lubert's company. I did a comic called Kafka, and I was paid whatever the costs minus the profits minus the costs, whatever was left over was split up with me and Stefano Gaudiano, my artist. And that was it. You know, and on the first issue, we made like $600. We're like, wow, we're in college. We made $600. The second issue, we made like $300. We're like, wow, we're in college. We made $300. Third and fourth issue, we made like $50. We're like, so that was my first job. When I started working at DC, which was the first mainstream company I was at, my rate was pretty low. But Karen Berger, God bless her heart, and Paul Levitz, for listening to her, kept pushing that rate up over time. And Shelley Bond really championed my rate.
Shelley.
And it got to be a pretty good rate, page rate. And I went back a couple of years ago. I always say last year, but with the pandemic, I don't know, might have been 4 years ago. yesterday or 5 years ago. But I did a Superman story for the Superman Blue and Red series.
Wow.
Editor Jamie Rich was like, you can do whatever you want, which is my favorite thing to hear for a comic. And so I did a story, and he called me. He's like, I'm really trying to fight to get you your rate. And I'm like, my rate from 10 or 12 years ago, the last time I worked there. Yeah. They don't pay anything like that now.
Wow.
You know, it's like, so it had, and I know people in the industry, so I know what it's gone down to, but it didn't go up as the economy went up and as, you know, fake Bitcoin money came in and business boomed and cover prices went up. Writer rates went down, and the rate that I was told was almost half of what I used to make monthly on my stuff. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to work for that. I'll just do my own thing over at Image. And so they got me my rate, but it was my rate from 10 years ago.
Jesus. That's insane. What? And I'm sorry, I missed your story. Tell me what your story was for that series.
I worked with somebody named Duncan Rulo, who drew it. And I, during the pandemic, my wife and I, Liesl, took in 2 foster kids, and then we adopted those kids.
Wow.
About a year ago. And it really gave us something to do during the pandemic, because we're old and they're older. They were 9 and 16 when they came.
That's but, great.
But we're seriously, still like, we're old. So it was like a lot to keep track of, even if you couldn't leave the house or talk to anybody. But so when Jamie said you can do whatever you want, I was thinking about foster kids, which is what Superman is essentially.
Yes.
And so I wrote a story about Martha kind of responding to the talk around town about her new foster kid and how, you know, that kid is her kid. It's not some rando.
Wow.
So it turned out pretty well. I really liked it. Duncan did a beautiful job on the art. And I was like experimental stories and forms and coloring and whatever. So that was fun for me to do. The only other Superman stuff I had done was the Vertigo It's a Bird book, which I still love and stand by. And then a run on Superman after that, even though people think I did that before, because the It's a Bird Vertigo book came out after.
Of course. No, I remember both. And in fact, I'll pop up a couple examples of images they re-released. Well, first of all, we should talk about your Superman run. And there's the 10-cent adventure, which...
Yeah, I mean, so this came after It's a Bird, but It's a Bird... I wrote It's a Bird first, which is a book for people who don't know about how much I don't like Superman. And I talked Paul Levitz... I talked Karen into asking Paul if I could do it, and then I talked Paul into doing it via a letter, which is a story of its own stuff. But it's a book about how I, as a kid, was given superhero comics. I did not like them. And the reason why is because Huntington's disease runs in my family. And to my mind, you know, genes and extra abilities were a negative thing. And so the idea of a super being didn't make any sense. Like the people in my family who had something extra, it was killing them. So I just didn't gravitate towards superheroes. And 20 short stories about Superman, all told in different art styles, which is why Teddy Christensen, the artist, got an Eisner, because he worked his butt off. That explained to me why Superman is the superior hero and what's cool about him in a myriad of ways. And so those short stories interrupt this ongoing narrative of me not wanting to write Superman, but agreeing to write Superman after my fictional editor in the comic is telling me, what the hell is wrong with you? He's the top superhero. I'm like, not for me, buddy. So I wrote that first, and that was kind of all I had to say about Superman.
Okay.
And then before that book had come out, Eddie Braganza, who was editing the Superman titles with all three of my Man of Action friends working on them,
yes,
asked me a couple times if I wanted to write Superman. I'm like, nope, I got nothing to say. I got nothing to do. And eventually he talked me into it, partly because I needed insurance and my monthlies at DC had ended, so I had to do something. And partly because I was like, you know what? I can do this. I wrote a whole book about how great he is. And then I found it just taxing and challenging. And poor Scott McDaniel, I think, would have loved for me to take a hike after a month or two, but I had to do a year. So, yeah.
I thought it was good. And I also loved what the Joes did as well, Kelly and Casey.
They had been on it a long time. And I was excited. I was like, oh, I'm going to go back, because we'd all done the X-Men together. And I was like, okay, well, we'll get that magic back, which, you know, that was, I don't know if magic is the word. But the day we started the first summit, when I became a writer of Superman, Dan DiDio came in. He's like, the Superman movie just fell apart with Brett Ratner. We don't want anything happening on these books this year. We don't want to draw any attention to these things because it can mess up the next movie setup. And I'm like, did I sign up for Superman literally the day nothing can happen? And the answer was, I did.
So what was your solution to that premise?
Well, you read it. I mean, I just...
It's been a while, but remind me.
I just said, I decided that, you know, there's the super and the man. So which way do you go? Well, It's a Bird is the man for the most part. So I said, I'm going to go science. I'm just going to go all super, go weird science. And I did what I could within the constraints that we had.
Okay. All right. Again, this is, by the way, everybody, this is the new cover. And,
that's the current edition with, it also has a little 2-page short story that we did for Superman Batman 75 called It's a Bat, which is a comedic, somewhat sequel to that book. Not that they're ever should or would be a sequel to that book.
Someone in the chat asked, and I was going to ask anyway, so I'm acknowledging the question, but also I want to ask myself, where's Teddy Krigstein? I mean, he had such a big splash. Are we missing his stuff? Is he overseas? What's going on with him?
Well, so Teddy, I love Teddy to death. I see him because I teach at a school in Denmark where Teddy lives, so I have been able to drop in on him even over the past 2 years when the pandemic eased off a little bit. So there's a lot with Teddy Christensen. One, he's been doing these super cute children's books in Denmark that are just gorgeous. They're not in English, so if you want to Google Translate or whatever, they're worth looking up. You just Google him and put in children's books, it'll probably show up. Beautiful art, worth looking at. Two, we have all the rights to House of Secrets back, except we have can't call it House of Secrets, obviously.
Sure.
The Vertigo book that we did together. So yes, we are literally minutes away from choosing the new title for that, and then we will announce some stuff that we will do with and for that property slash project slash creative love of ours. Three, he and I have been working on a new book for 10 years. It's a bear. It's a weird one because what we've been doing since It's a Bird was It's a Bird is a biography. Then we do an experimental book. Then we do a biography. The next one was Genius. Then we do an experimental book. That one was Red Diary after that one. Okay. So the next book is another experimental book. And it's such a bizarre experiment that it's just, it's taking forever. But it's going to be cool. We're calling it right now Mercury. We have no idea what it will be called because we don't know what it's about. Neither one of us. Because the work process is that Teddy is painting 240 rectangular images from a narrative that he's imagining in his head. And I get these 240 images when they're done out of sequence, like a jigsaw puzzle. And I'm going to sequence those and then write a script. And then that will be the book. So whatever he's got in mind is not the book. I don't have anything in mind because I have no idea what he's drawing. And we neither one of us knows what the order of the book will be. And then in this weird frenzy, some book will come into being that neither one of us knew we were working on.
That sounds, hey man, that sounds great. It sounds appropriately experimental.
Yes, he's got 130 some images done of 240. So we're moving much faster than we have been. That's what I
okay. Say. Well, even the re-release of whatever you guys decide House of Secrets will be called, you know, this is a great excuse for us to talk again when that time comes. Sure. But also, are there other Vertigo creator-owned stuff that was under the Vertigo imprint that has reverted back to you and you can do what you want with it?
Yes, I have American Virgin with Becky Cloonan and others.
Sure.
Many talented people. I have Vertigo with Mike Allred. That was a one shot that we did. I already republished The Crusades with Kelly Jones.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, Image Comics with my new most beloved home. Sandman Mystery Theater, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, new volume, man. I pulled up one of my favorite covers.
Yeah, a new collection of stuff, which is quite awesome. You know, it's never been fully collected. There's supposed to be a second volume coming out soon. I'm looking up one thing that I'm trying through. Oh, yeah, of course. The CMYK books, I don't have any control over those, or Flinch or the other stuff that I did there. Okay. But all the creator-owned books that I had, one at a time over many, many years, I've managed to get them all back. And I'm just trying to decide, you know, which way am I going with all that? What am I doing? Yeah.
Well, that's great. And honestly, again, because they were so unique, you know, you can turn them on to a new audience and it's, you know, it's new to them. I mean, and I think that's wonderful, man.
It is. And it's one of the best things about comics is that, you know, I haven't done a convention in probably 4 years because of the pandemic and the adoption and the whatever. I'm hoping to put my foot back in that soon.
Great.
What I love is that I used to be like, whatever book you had out, that's what you were promoting. And if you didn't have a new book, why bother? And now it really is that Kafka, which is the first thing I did, I put back out through Image, and people come up and that's their first book by me and they've never heard of it, you know? And so I have to really just keep a mindset of, oh, okay, you come to this stuff whenever you come to it. And it's, you know, I try to make things that are not specifically temporal unless they are a period piece. Stuff lasts if you make it, you know.
Absolutely. Well. Absolutely, man. No.
And by the way, the House of Secrets makes a little appearance in the latest Shelley Bond Kickstarter book. She's doing her trifecta of editorial volumes that are both biography and creative encyclopedia. And we did a 3 or 4 page story that has Rain and one of the jurists' faults talking about Shelley's secrets. So hunt that down.
That's fantastic. You know, seriously, man, especially during the pandemic, I really got to know Shelley that much better. And we really have parallel lives in terms of she was a college radio person. I was a college radio person and we're, you know, at that same age and everything. So we're, you know, we're very simpatico with a lot of things. I hope I didn't call her out by referring to the fact she's slightly younger. All right, let's put it that way.
Slightly younger than me. Slightly. No, I've known Shelley almost as long as I've been in comics, because I did the book for Denny at Renegade. Then I did the Amazon with Tim Sale at Kimiko. And then my third project was slated to be this book with Mike Allred called Jaguar Stories that Shelley was editing for their Keyline Books line, a 12-issue maxi series that has never seen the light of day. What's done of it? We're always talking about ways to make that something. I think I have a new idea that I might try to do. But yeah, Shelley is that long ago in my atlas.
I hear you, man.
I was also a maid of honor at her wedding. So,
oh, that's great. Wow. At her wedding, with her and
Philip? Her wedding to Philip, yes. Yeah. I told her I want to go in the women's bathroom because I've never been in there. So she made me her maid of honor because I'd have to carry her little train behind her as she went in. And you know what? It's pretty much the same, just no urinals.
But they got usually in the good ones, they have a place to sit down. Not that I frequent women's
bathrooms. It was a lot cleaner. It was a lot cleaner.
That's true, too.
Probably just because women are more careful.
Of course, indeed. Who knew we were going to talk about this? That's a fantastic subject.
You know, Scorpio is there in the comments. He's saying, I'd love to have people tell everyone about Get Naked. But I got to tell you, if I write a book called Get Naked, of course I'm going to talk about urinals on your podcast. So.
I respect that. Absolutely, man. Well, you've opened the can by acknowledging Scorpio's question about that. Do you want to talk about Get Naked?
I certainly can. I pulled it down because I saw the question.
What? All right, zooming in.
Yes.
There it is.
This is a collection of essays, comic book essays, about me specifically, God help us, getting naked. But it's I love essays. I love the form. I love Spalding Gray's performance essays, performance monologues that he did. Definitely love David Sedaris, who's made a whole career out of writing essays and then reading essays. And the reason that you and I know each other kind of is because Lisa was teaching speech. Right. College page, because we met on our college speech team at the University of Colorado, which is where I know Scorpio from. Shout out to Colorado and Boulder specifically. And I have not really ever performed per se. I did the whole time I was on speech team, speech and debate in college. That's all I did. I traveled. Then I coached a team and I watched other people perform. And I was, you know, missing it at some point. I was like, I'd like to get out there and read some stuff again. And I was thinking about what I should do is mix what I do, comic books and this kind of performative essay stuff, these kind of comedy stories. And I just played around in Photoshop going, what would an essay comic book be like without the text, which there would be more of, trashing the art? Because I hate text-heavy comics that are too much text. And I could not for the life of me get anything that worked. Like it all just looked like, you know, pictures with text bothering it. And I teach at this school, as I mentioned, in Denmark called the Animation Workshop. Teddy got me in the door there, and I've been lucky to go back for each class that they get every 2 years, new students. And so I talked to one of the professor's coordinators there, and I said, you know, how about we do an exercise where I make it an assignment for your students to figure out what a comic book essay looks like, because I sure can't. And they draw them. We'll do it like a workshop where in 10 days, they each do a 10-page story adapting one of these essays that I write. And if it's good, we'll publish it through Image. And if it's bad, we'll just say it was an assignment. And they were like, we'll do it. So I was like, okay, well, shit, now I got to write 19 essays, which I had not written essays before. Though I like them, it's a different form. So
sure.
I was hustling to figure out, like, what is this going to be about? And I was like, well, okay, it's not going to sell because it's essays and it's comic books. So it's either got to have the word sex, naked, or gun in the title. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do guns. I don't have any gun stories, really. I'm not going to do my sex stories because, A, no one wants to hear about that, and, B, I don't want to talk about that. Or maybe I do. Maybe when I'm old. I got some good ones. But then I was like, well, I can't do naked because I'm just never naked anywhere. Except that one time in Germany. I was like, oh, and except that, and except for Korea. And what I realized was that anytime I leave the U.S., I seem to be naked. Against my will mostly, but it turns out okay. And when I'm in the U.S., I'm not. And so that became the thing. I was like, okay, well, I want to write essays about what's going on in the U.S. that when you're not in the U.S., you and everybody else can be naked, alone or together or whatever. And in the U.S., this country just dominated by sex and sexuality and violence, a nude body went from being this thing that was fine to absolutely not.
Yes.
And I found some stuff online about how swimming in high school used to be nude for men.
Yes.
Like public high schools and the YMCA and gyms and whatever. You just take off your clothes, jump in the pool with all your classmates, swim for an hour. The gym teacher would hand you a towel and off you'd go.
Yep,
and sure. I was like, I heard about that when I was in high school, when I was in junior high, people were always like, you got to be naked in swim class. You got to be naked in swim class. And then when I got there, nobody was naked in swim class. And I was like, thank God, because I can't even swim, let alone be naked. And so the more I looked into that, the more it was like, well, that is true for broad swaths of the country. What the hell happened? Like, what corner did we turn? So these essays are about that shift and kind of the global alternative to that. And the students at the animation workshop, there are 19 of them, or I'd name them by name, killed it. They were amazing. Like, they solved what a comic book essay looks like 19 different ways. Like, I couldn't figure out one, and they came up with 19 totally different ways to do it. And I showed it to Eric Stevens. He's like, yeah, we'll publish this. I'm like, hallelujah. And they did. And then it got 2 Eisner nominations. I never win, never. So I knew I wouldn't win, and I didn't. But it's an honor to be nominated.
Yeah, that's that happened to me. I got nominated for a Chicago Emmy and did not win. So I understand that. The swimming thing, much like you, thank God, we're of that generation that was allowed to have suits. But yeah, everyone I know that was older is like, oh yeah, we swam naked all the time. And it's like, wow.
Yeah. But isn't it interesting?
Go ahead.
I swam naked in Berlin. I have a mild heart condition, so I have to swim every day, which is funny because I could not swim until I was 30.
Wow.
But when I was told I have to run or swim every day and I ran for a week, I was like, okay, time to learn how to swim because this running.
I'm so with you, dude. Swimming is low impact. It's fun. Steve, as a guy who's written his share of Superman and even It's a Bird, I feel like I'm flying when I'm swimming. I really do.
I'm still terrified of water because up until I was 30, because I couldn't swim, I assumed I would drown if I got in a pool. And I swam today. I swim every day.
Good.
I swam today. When I get into the pool, I literally go, don't drown. That's the first thing I think. But then I start swimming. I love it.
Okay, good.
But I swam in a pool in Berlin because I had just gotten this diagnosis where it was like, I got to swim all the time. And they sent me to a rooftop kind of spa with a swimming pool thing. And I had not been to many spas, let alone one in Germany. And everybody was just naked. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to swim in this pool naked. Okay, well, I've gotten over that. I did that part. What I didn't understand was that the pool on the roof went from inside to outside.
Oh no.
And so I'm doing the backstroke and I'm like, my dick is out and everyone in these office buildings is looking at it. Which they were not, of course. No one cares. What makes you think they needed binoculars? So that story is in the book and a bunch of other ones about just random places I got naked.
That's outstanding. You know, Mr. Skin of internet fame is a regular guest here at Word Balloon. And honestly, I it's so easy to go into Morning Zoo, just, you know, hey, look at that girl. Hey, whatever. But honestly, and it's great because he appreciates it. I'm like, isn't it interesting that movies have gotten so much more conservative, yet streaming television and cable, anything goes. Good Lord, I saw the debut of Lily Rose Depp's show, The Idol, on HBO on Sunday. And of course, Euphoria preceding it. And of course, same creator as Euphoria. And it's like, wow, man, that's amazing of how the mores have changed from film to television. And yeah, it seems like television. Yeah,
Working on Sandman Mystery Theater with Guy Davis, we did a ton of research. And one of the things that came up was how much porn there was back then and how that porn was really similar to the porn we have now. Like the camera angles, the subject matter, the choice, it's the same shit we have now. So we pretend like, oh, this never happened. It happened all the time. It's always the same. And so I started wondering about that over the course of working on this book in particular. And I didn't really address this in there. But I think what it boils down to is that in a patriarchal society, male-driven, we don't mind naked women. Naked women all day long, naked women in the park, naked, 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 whatever. It's the penis that we're like, oh my God, I don't want to see one of those. I've got one, but I don't want to see another one. And it's like that phobia seems to be the linchpin of all of this. There can't be equality because we don't want to see a penis. We don't mind seeing women, but we can't see women because we don't want to see men and we don't want to pretend like there's a double standard, but there's a giant double standard. It's the same thing on television. You know, Euphoria, naked women, floor to ceiling, wall to wall, no one's trying to say there. but, you know, there's a penis shown on the episode. Oh my gosh, what are they doing to television? It's ridiculous. Then you go to Germany and you swim naked in a co-ed facility where it's men, women, kids, grandpas, or you go to Korean spa where it's grandma, grandpa, you know, segregated, but whatever. And in about 3 minutes you go, this doesn't matter. This is a false thing. Because like I said, nobody wants to see me naked. They shouldn't. But I could care less now. And it took about 3 minutes.
That's great, man. Well, you know, ironically, there was another HBO show a while ago, and I don't remember the title, but the conceit of the show was it was an anthology show, and you followed this, I want to say, New York pot dealer. And I do remember seeing some crank on that show, some male frontal nudity. And I'm like, oh, all right. You know what? And again, my, just like you said, it's like, well, you know, we see women all the time. All right, fine, whatever. It didn't offend me or anything like that. So it is weird. Oh, hey, look who's watching, bud. It's Nick Burrus.
Nick.
Thank
you. I'm secretly doing a thing for Nick. I can't talk about it, I don't think.
Thank you, man. No, and he said, that is the best guess. Well, that's very nice, Nick. Thank you. And he's telling everyone to like and hit the thumbs up.
Yay.
Everybody, listen, I've only really made this part of the show recently. You know, it's just a weird financial time. I mean, it is. And so if you have a question, please hit that streaming.
Here's what I want to do, John, because you got this new thing going. Everything I do is like fans matter the most. That's my philosophy. So because this is new and because I'm here, if any of these people have questions that have not tipped you, you go ahead and ask those questions and I'll pay their tip.
Oh, Steve, that's,
I don't care. I don't want anybody feeling left out of this convo. These
you're
are
very nice kind, people. Steve. That's very sweet. I that's very, very
try
nice.
Try to find me when this thing's over.
No. No. Excuse me. It was Greg that we wanted to pop up then. He wanted to know what your working relationship with Dave Johnson was on Ben 10. He loves his designs. I didn't know Dave was working for you guys on Ben 10.
Well, that was it was quite a while ago. Ben 10 is about 15 years old at this point. And
true.
Dave was after Duncan, who did the original designs, Dave did the actual original designs when the show went into production. And Dave is a genius. We all know that. One of the best cover artists working, one of the best just graphic designers in general. That is not Dave's art. So
sorry, Dave.
It's also good art, but just to not confuse anybody. But Dave did an amazing job. I will tell you this, though, that Dave is the reason my poker game ended. I had a slight, you know, low stakes, low testosterone poker game for comic book people in my neighborhood for a while. And Dave Johnson heard about it. He's like, I want to come to that game. We're like, yeah, come on. And he came over and destroyed us. Like it was just a penny ante kind of game. And he wanted all the pennies, speaking of getting all the money. And I was like, I don't know if I can have this game again, because Dave will just take all of our money and all of our joy. I said, I canceled the game instead of having it again, because I was so offended by what a good poker player he was. But no, he's a lovely person and an astonishing talent who deserves all the praise he can get.
Another one of my favorite people in comics. I always love seeing David at shows and stuff. And that's truly, man, you know, thank God we are getting out of COVID. Although now, good Lord, the East Coast, you and I are lucky beyond me in the Midwest and you on the West Coast.
I was in meetings all day with Joe Kelly, and all he kept saying was, is your sky red? Is this Crisis on Infinite Earths? He didn't say that, but I knew that people might like the comic reference.
No, I hear you, man. Nick is asking why I don't have these super chats set up. You know, Nick, I did. And all of a sudden, YouTube took it away from me, and I'm not sure why. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. In the meantime, I'm using Streaming Elements, which people can use via PayPal and stuff like that. And Nick has been very kind and tipped me in the past, and I do appreciate that. So no, and really, Steve, that's really generous. I don't,
You might have been talking when I said I'm doing a secret project for Nick that I can't mention, but I am.
No, I heard you say that. Absolutely.
Okay, because you didn't react at all. You were just like, eh.
Oh, no. Well, I figured I didn't want to tip anything. And when I say tip, I don't mean pay. But no.
You know, exactly. Nick may not know about it. It's already set up, Nick. We're good.
Wow. Excellent. There you go. And he said, yeah, get it set up. Absolutely. That's great. No, seriously, man. Nick, thank you.
You're going to work tomorrow and go, who the hell is working with Siegel? Cancel that thing.
No. And he says, I'm honored to be working with Steven. Hey, aww, man, it's truly. Yeah. Oh, and he says, trust me, I know that it's set up. Good deal. Well, that's good. I'm excited to see what you guys might have cooking and everything.
Yeah, it'll be unexpected for sure.
Is it without going into detail, is it an original thing or is it a licensed
product? I'm not going to answer any more questions.
See, there you go.
Well, I mean, I'll answer more questions. Not that question.
Not that question. Fair enough, man. I was going to say, how far are we away from an announcement? But I guess that's between you and Nick.
Might be. And maybe others.
That's awesome. He says, I keep asking Matt once every week.
I know, and Matt asks us every day. So it is just us who's slow, not Matt.
No problem. Truly, man, I'm so glad that you are, actively doing comics again, because that was my wonder to a degree. Because really, you watched me talking to Shelley and Diana Schutz a couple months ago, which was great. And I'm like, oh man, what's Steve doing? So it is really great to hear that you're doing new things, and also you have control over what you're,
out there. Yeah, I'm doing a book with an artist in Argentina named Fernando Calvi that we haven't announced and we won't announce till we're much farther along. That's an original. I haven't figured out a time frame in which Becky and I can figure out what to do with American Virgin, but controlling it is great. Like, that book was canceled at 23, but it was supposed to go to 24, right? So now if we decide to, we can just do 24 and make that thing complete, or just do new miniseries. Becky had some thoughts about that were cool. So it's really just timing and figuring that stuff out. House of Secrets, I would love to do a lot with when it's not called that anymore. That was, yeah. I licensed the title from DC for $1, by the way. So they're not being evil. It always said in my contract that I couldn't keep the title when I went away. So that all makes sense perfectly fine. And the new book with Teddy, I did two Camp Midnight books with Jason Katzenstein. We may get back to that someday as well. We have a third story in mind, but he's too talented for me at the moment, but maybe I'll lure him back. I love to do comics. I can't wait to do more comics. It wasn't for lack of interest. It really was adopting kids and a pandemic was a lot on top of the Man of Action work.
That's excellent, man. Hey, Scorpio Steel just donated, and that's very kind, man.
Nice.
See, I'm not, hey, man, I'm not asking for a ton. It's a small amount, and I genuinely appreciate it, man. That's nice. And Wesley says also the Word Balloon Patreon, once you get set up for the $1 default, you can change it to a higher end amount. A lot of people have been doing that, and it's very kind. Everyone's really nice. God, I feel like, I'm Jerry Lewis running the telethon right now.
So Wesley also was asking about the Red Diary.
Yes.
I have all my books up here, but for people who don't know, it was a Danish graphic novel. This is actually the legit deal. And Teddy sent it to me, and it was gorgeous. Like, it's just a beautiful, I love being on camera. It's like,
Attaboy, you look good.
It'll be beautiful.
Oh, stand by. I'll open it up again.
Wow.
We'll let people see.
Beautifully painted, whatever. And he was like, do you think Image would publish it? I'm like, yeah, you got to translate it. He's like, you should translate it. I'm like, I do not speak Danish, so no. And he's like, well, I don't think I would do a good job of it. So I'm like, meh. And I had it. I just kept looking at it, going, I wonder what this thing's about. And so I started imagining what it was about. And then I started making up what it was about. And then I wrote to Teddy and I said, how about I translate it guessing? Like, I'm just going to guess what I think is happening here, because I think I got it after looking at it for 2 years. And he's like, oh yeah, that sounds good, which is not a good idea. So I'm surprised he thought that sounded like a good idea. And I did. So what I did was I took his book and I literally kept everything where it is. And anywhere he had a word balloon, I put the same length of a word balloon. And anywhere he'd use like the word Paris, I would use the word Paris. So if there was a word that, made sense, or a year or whatever,
sure,
I would take that and I would put it in, and then I would just make up the rest of it, like a similarly count word count kind of thing. And I guessed what the book was about and wrote all that up. And then I sent it to Teddy. I'm like, here's what your book is about. And then he wrote back. He's like, that's not at all what my book is. And then he sent me a translation that he did. And I was like, oh my God, these are like wildly different. Like, your main character is not even my main character. And I'm not even in the right year, even though I thought I was. And
so that's World War One, basically.
Yeah. So we published that. It's a flip book. It's got his on one side. I cleaned up his transition using Google Translate, which was really good, actually. And then the other version with the same pages in the same order and the same word balloons, but a totally different story. And that was our last crazy experiment, Wesley. It was fun. It was also unnerving because there were some pages at the end that had a totally different format. And I'm like, I was done with my kind of, here's what I think it is. And I'm like, what about these pages? And so just trying to solve that. And I'm doing another book that's an even weirder extension of that. After I get done with the Teddy book, or maybe during, I don't know, that I can't talk about yet, but soon.
That's That's incredible, man. You know, it reminds me, I don't know if you remember, there was a Batman manga called City of Dreams that was translated by, and now suddenly the name escapes me. Max Allen Collins.
Yeah.
And essentially the same thing happened. He really just took the images and wrote his own story and everything. I don't know if you ever heard what Kia, and I forget how to say
it. Sama or something like that? I can't remember.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know. I never heard a response from him, but I'm glad. That sounds great that you and Teddy were able to come up with this. That's great.
Well, you know, I have a writer's group that we don't read each other's work. We just sit and write all day at a Korean spa in LA. Been doing it for 12 years, once a week. And one of the things I do talk about with new writers who show up is just to say, there are so many ways to get at this. Like, how do you write a comic book? Well, you know, everybody has their little system, but I try to not. I try to have a new system for each project, because once you get your toolbox, where you're like, I understand theme, I understand character, I understand pacing, I know how to write to visual storytelling and how to not overwrite for it because the pictures do most of the work, you know, then there are other ways to get at it. Like, I don't need to give Teddy a script for us to come up with a cool comic. He can just start drawing and I can make something out of that. Or he can make a comic and I can make something else out of that. Or I can write him a full script, or I can write an outline and he can do that. And I can, like with Guy Davis, I wrote all the dialogue after Guy had drawn from a matte plot most of the time. So, you know, I saw a lot of stuff in the acting that his characters did on the page, and I knew what the setup was, but I never had any idea what they were going to be talking about until I looked at them and said, they must be talking about their relationship on the skids or whatever. And that all came from just visual cues. The guy, not knowing what the dialogue would be, was putting in, and he didn't write me and go, they're talking about their relationship, right? It was just a trust of people using their skills to make comics. And there's a million different ways to get there. But every time you go to one of these panels, it's like, here's exactly how you, it's like, no, there's no exactly. And different artists need different things too. Like, I can't draw, I wish I could, but I can't. So when I work with artists, I'm like, what do you want out of a script? Because that's the person the script is for. So if Teddy, for example, likes a full script with everything explained most of the time, but he can also get tired of that. So House of Secrets was him saying, I wish every story arc was different. And I said, well, okay, it will be. And the scripts will be different. We'll change the form of the scripts so that you're not always dealing with the same kind of schematic to get there.
Yeah.
And that stuff can go up in flames, and some of my stuff does, but it can also get you something that nobody else does, which is what my stuff usually does, hopefully.
That's really incredible, man. And I really want to get into Sandman Mystery Theater, and you've already opened the door explaining that. So is that, because I wondered how you guys were dividing stories. And I've talked to Matt about what he did, but it's great to talk to you as well. First of all, and really, if anyone watching, and I'm so glad that the new big omnibus is out there, because yeah, man, I know. I don't want to give you a hernia. Look at that dictionary size, man. Jesus Christ.
Definitely half of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm so glad they're doing that, because truly I bought the issues back in the day, but I didn't keep them. And I'm like, God, I really miss those stories. And it's Wesley Dodd's year. I mean, it's DC Heroes year one. And Wesley, I love the idea. And please tell me how much of it was Matt and I want to hear your involvement, but the idea that Wesley Dodd's this guy who was in the Justice Society and originally had the gas mask and the cloak and the hat, but then transitioned into a more traditional looking superhero when Simon and Kirby were doing their Sandman stuff. But it was that original creator, and it seemed like your guy's stories were based on his first 10 stories. You guys have expanded them into 5 or 6 issue arcs. But essentially, it was these first 10, they were 10-page stories, essentially, in Adventure Comics or whichever one they were originally hosted in. So I loved it, because it really was like, originally Golden Age Superman was the first hero and stuff. But I really like this idea of, well, if it wasn't, you know, him, you had Dr. Occult, you had Sandman, you had Slam Bradley, these characters that were adventurers but really weren't superheroes per se. So tell me how you got involved and you know what you feel you contributed to these amazing stories.
That's a lot. First of all,
sorry, bud.
Leandro hooked us up that it's Kia Asamiya. So
yes, indeed. Yes, thank you, man.
Thanks for that. But yeah,
for the Batman City of Dreams.
Yeah, so if you've read the Sandman, Neil Gaiman Sandman, or watched the TV show, you know, Sandman is imprisoned, spoiler alert, for 100 years, I think, in a glass ball. And Matt's idea was, during the time that he's imprisoned, that dream energy funnels itself into Wesley Dodds, who then has these dreams that just compel him to go out in this gas mask, which looks kind of like the Morpheus mask, and gas people and right wrongs. You know, so it's kind of like a weird psychosis, sleep deprivation kind of combo thing. So that's our story, is that the Sandman channels this kind of idea from Morpheus and doesn't know what to do with it or how to act on it. He's not really a hero. He's kind of, you know, slightly overweight like all of us. He doesn't work out because the 30s, and that wasn't so much.
Yeah, he's this dumpy. He's this dumpy little guy. Go on.
Yeah, and so he goes out to kick ass, but he often gets his own ass kicked because what the hell is he doing? But he can't stop. He's compelled. And so Matt did a year of that with Guy Davis on the first arc, R.G. Taylor, and I just had it and I just blew it. But I've got a book.
Stand by,
because it's right here. And it's odd that I could. John Watkiss, of course. Jesus.
Oh, sure.
I just talked about him in another podcast 2 weeks ago, and I'm suddenly blanking. That's how my brain is now, so apologies.
It's all good, man. I'm doing the same thing. Don't sweat it.
He did those three arcs, and then he wanted to go back to Mage. And so he told Karen, he's like, I got to quit this book because I got to go back to Mage. She's like, don't quit. Get a co-writer. And for whatever reason, he called me up, which I had done one Grindle Tales story for him on Grindle 40, and that's it. And we had met maybe once or twice when he was on tour places. We were not lifelong pals or anything, but I was stunned. I was like, why is he calling me? And I had already been to DC and gotten Primal Force, which I think Steven was mentioning.
Indeed.
And some other stuff set up. And I was like, I don't have time for this. Matt's really talented, but he's going to be a hothead. He's going to be very bossy. And I'm very bossy and it's not going to work out. And he's like, hey, just fly up to Portland and we'll talk about it. It's like, well, I do like his cooking and Portland sounds fun. So I went up there and literally over the course of dinner, we were just figuring out the next year. Like his Jedi mind trick was not to ask how we would work. It was literally to just start working, which we did. And it was seamless. And I was just visiting him a week ago. I was at a wedding up in Portland and he made me lunch and it was so good. We didn't have a speed bump even. Like we didn't have a disagreement about a plot point ever. It's so weird. Because you would think that headstrong creators would butt, but we did not. It was just really easy from the get-go. So my job when I came on at number 13 was to do dialogue. So Matt would do the plot, okay. Guy would lay it out, I would write the dialogue, it would be lettered, and then Guy would ink it up, and that was it. That was the first year. Then Matt's like, I did another year, that's 2 years, I got to get off of this thing. And I'm like, no, I'll work with you on the plots. So we did the plots, same process, whatever. He's like, 3 years is too long in the tooth. I got to go. And I'm like, nope. You give me a paragraph, and I'll turn that into a page for each part of the, you know. So it's just, how can I hang on to Matt as long as I possibly can? And then the fifth year, he's like, I'm out of here. There was no holding on to him. And then the book was canceled. So there you go.
Wow. And, man, I am telling you, truly one of my absolute favorite Vertigo series. And I've told Matt this as well. And I really loved that there was a Vertigo bent on DC's Golden Age. And Matt told me, he's like, I didn't ask for permission. I just did what I want. Fuck them. You know, and it's
we both had people who dug it like you. And then we had people who would write in and be like, you're really disrespecting them. And it's like, no, like these stories, we read the other stories. We contextualize them. This is a street level crime comic. So if we're going to have the Simon Kirby Sandman costume, it needs to be at a New Year's, you know, masquerade ball where people are costumed. Because that's not part of this world, but we will acknowledge it and we will say it existed at the time. You know, the Phantom of the World's Fair, Sandman was in DC's World's Fair comics in 1939.
Yes.
He just said that the Phantom was a serial killer and showed you what they couldn't show you in 1939. So it was highly respectful of the stuff because we wanted it to fit right in. We didn't want to piss on everything. It was the opposite.
No, I loved it, man. I loved as you know, I acknowledged one of my favorite covers and one of my favorite stories was the Hourman story.
Yeah.
And then also when you guys introduced the Crimson Avenger coming in.
Who, when the book was canceled early, you know, it was always 4-issue arcs. And okay. I kept asking him, like, our sales are bad. Are we being canceled? No, 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 you're not being canceled. Are we being canceled? No, no, no. And I was just like, really just doing 4 issues. And I at the end there, I was like, okay, there's no way these sales are going to keep us going. And Karen's like, I haven't heard anything. I think we're fine. So I plotted out 4 issues. And she's like, oh, no, they're only giving us 2 issues to wrap it up. And I'm like, bitch, we do 4. Like, this is a 4-issue series. That's what we do. For the rest of time, there's going to be missing 2 issues from this story. She's like, well, you just need to put it all into 2. And I thought, you know what? Fuck that. I'm not going to put it into 2. I'm going to have Wes and Diana leave after part 2. They've got other stuff to do. They're going to hand it over to the Crimson Avenger and Burke and go, we got to go to Europe. Sorry, don't have time to solve this one.
Wow.
And that's the way the series ends.
Did you write or did someone else write the eventual, like, when Diane Belmont, right? That was his, like, they were Nick and Nora Charles, basically, people. Yeah. If you haven't read this Sandman Mystery Theater series, it was amazing. But there was, I know James Robinson brought Wesley back like in his 90s.
Yeah, that was actually during Sandman Mystery Theater. So at that time, James and I were very good friends. And Matt obviously knew James because we had both done Grindle Tales by that point. James just had this idea to say, what if they came to Starman and we saw what happened to them? And that seemed like a cool idea. And we said, well, what if the Mist actually showed up long before Starman and we see where he came from?
Yes.
So we did the origin story of the Mist and he did the denouement of Wes and Diane as kind of a loose crossover. They came out at the same time, but they aren't really a crossover.
It was so good, man. And really, and it was probably James's Starman where Wesley's 90 and he's got someone's got him at gunpoint and he pulls out the gas gun and you get this great like thought bubble from Jack saying, my God, he's smiling. Cause it's like Wesley's done this a million times. And at this point it's like, you think I'm scared of you? Fuck you.
Yeah. Well, Diana's won the Pulitzer Prize for literature. She became a novelist and Wes is just kind of hanging around. So it gave him a little purpose again to do something.
Absolutely. And also there was a great Lamont Cranston, Margot Lane vibe. I don't know if that was in your mind, but it certainly was in mine, being a big Shadow fan.
Yeah, definitely in Matt's original DNA. But I think we, you know, for my money, I'm terrible with mysteries, so I could care less what the mystery was. And he's like, that's fine. Some can be Columbo, where we already know who did it. I was like, thank God, because I'm no Agatha Christie. But I loved the idea of a romance comic wrapped in all of that. I love research. I love the 30s. I have a World's Fair bedroom in my house, so I'm like, fan of the World's Fair. So I was into all of that. And the idea that it shifted between 4 issues from Wes's perspective narratively and then 4 issues of Diane's narratively back and forth over the whole run of the series was magic. You know, to be able to be in a different headspace from 2 different sides of a relationship as that relationship goes through weird New York City murders, crimes, whatever, what we call hate crimes now, and the blossoming of World War II, that was great. That was just, I couldn't ask for more fun.
Honestly, man, a Guy's art was so perfect. And because he would draw real people. They were
Davis can draw anything, first of all. So I've known Guy since he was at Caliber, because Kafka was republished by Caliber long, long, long ago. And I met him at a con. He had a giant mohawk. And I was like, this guy's scary, but he's actually one of the nicest guys you've ever imagined. And I asked him after probably 2 years on the book, he drew something. I'm like, where are you getting this research? Like, I go inside of a damn power reactor control center and you just draw it. Like, where are you finding? He's like, I don't use any research. And I'm like, what? And it's, he can just, like, if you tell him something, he will draw it and you will believe it. And back then there was no internet to look stuff up.
Sure.
And he lives in a little tiny town in the middle of, at the time, near Detroit. And it's like, it's not like there's some massive research library. He was just making it up, but he's that good at making it up.
That's fantastic. And really, his atmosphere was very Dashiell Hammett. I mean, it really had that 30s detective vibe going on and stuff, and the parlor room kind of murders and things like Lord Peter Wimsey, British Dorothy Sayers, the writer of Peter Wimsey. No, it had that vibe, man, and it was so great. And it really, again, it was so great at a time when the Golden Age Superman was like, no, you know, we got to stick with modern Superman, and they kind of eliminated Earth 2. And it really just filled in on, for me, it filled in all the blanks of, okay, this is what, you know, DC in the 30s or the DC universe in the 30s looked like without a Superman. And it was great.
Well, thank you. I mean, good stories are about something. So what Matt did really well was he contextualized modern problems in the past, and those problems existed. There was gay bashing back then, and we had story arcs about that. You know, there were serial killers back then. We had story arcs about that. He started with that. He was like, well, here's the kind of shock value for you. But the stories were always about how that was resonating against this relationship. So like, you know, we have a creepy baby villain and his creepy mom who turns out not to be his mom. But that's against Wes and Diane having an unplanned pregnancy. And what do you do about this baby, right? You know, upend your whole life. Wow. So the stories were about real things. And we tried to make the couple seem as real as we could. And then they were still fun because they had that kind of garish, noirish kind of villain base to them.
It was excellent, man. Phoenix 720 didn't know about the Starman connection. He says he's reading Starman for the first time. Cool to hear the connection between the characters and stories. Yeah, man. No, it's Ted Knight and Wesley Dodds were friends, and it's again, it's you that wonderful scene, and I'm certain that the Sandman's there in All-Star number 4, where you get the Justice Society in front, you know, around the round table and everything, and the Sandman's there. But it's like this is like moments of, you know, these friends, and you get to know these people better and stuff. It's great.
Totally, I'm seeing Phoenix 720 asking a Ben 10 question. I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, but
oh, feel free.
He just wanted to know if we would do another Ben 10 comic and where, because he loved the Cartoon Network Action Pack. I actually wrote one of those Cartoon Network Action Packs. The Man of Action did the first 4 of those. That was fun. Those were great. Those were really, really fun. That ran a long time. IDW did a Ben 10 series. They might still be doing. I can't ever keep track of where those licenses are. The interesting thing is, you know, that Ben 10 is a big franchise, so that stuff can be licensed out and done somewhere else. Or it can be done through whatever publishing arm Warner Brothers controls. They own Ben 10 outright. So we are attached to life. We have a lovely participation creatively and financially in that. So we have no angst there, but we do not control where that stuff goes. That's all controlled by the corporation, as they say. So I don't have an answer for you. And guess what? If I did, I couldn't tell you the answer because I'm always signed to non-disclosure agreements that don't let me say anything of use.
I'll ask the question. You could either confirm or deny, but I had heard that Ben 10 originally started as a concept of Dial H for Hero.
That is completely false.
Okay.
It comes up a lot because there's a watch and a phone and different heroes and whatever.
Sure.
So the real origin story of Ben 10, and I hate to say this because I love comics, but the Man of Action guys primarily were Marvel when we were younger.
Yes.
So none of us knew Dial H for Hero. Legit.
Wow.
Didn't know about it.
Sure.
If we did, we would just tell you because we wouldn't care. It's not similar enough that anybody can
see us. No, and it is totally it is different. Go on.
And Warner Brothers owns DC anyway, so it wouldn't matter. So I would just tell you if that's what it was. There's no lawsuit there. But it was not an influence. What it came from was the short version of this, because I've told the story too many times in too many places.
Forgive me, yes.
The Robot Chicken guys came up to us when we had this table at Comic-Con that we didn't know what we were doing with the third year. And they're like, hey, you guys do cartoons, don't you? And we're like, sure, even though none of us had done a cartoon. And they're like, good, because Cartoon Network wants a boys action thing that's like Fantastic Four, and we don't do that, but you do. And then they, you know, walked off. That was Matt Senreich. We're like, I don't know what he thinks we do, but we don't do that. But let's go pitch Cartoon Network anyway. And because there were 4 of us and we had worked on the same things creatively, but we had not worked together except on the X-Men writers room and the Superman writers room. But that's just spitballing ideas. And that's eventually what our company became. But at the time we were all like, my idea is the good one. I want to pitch my idea. And we couldn't narrow down what we should pitch to one thing. So we pitched 20 things to Cartoon Network in 20 minutes, 1 minute pitches, stopwatch, bell, literally wherever you were in the pitch, we just moved on to the next one. And we had worked on those together. So I had a pitch called 9 that was about a superhero who had a watch thing that every time he hit it, he got another degree bigger, stronger, whatever. And Duncan liked the watch thing, but didn't like the bigger thing. He was like, that's just the Hulk. And he was like, he should have, you know, 10 different superpowers, or maybe Joe Casey. I can't remember who did what at this point. But it was like, okay, well, there's some there. So we started kicking that around. And the initial concept was that this kid, when he hits the watch, swaps with another dimension version of himself, like a dimension of fire and he's heat blast, a dimension of gravity and he can fly. And what? So it was different versions of Ben from different dimensions. That's kind of what Cartoon Network bought. Then they did a focus group and said, kids don't understand dimensions. you know, or maybe they just decided kids don't understand him. I think the multiverses of Spider-Man and Marvel have disproved that theory. Kids do understand dimensions. But anyway, it was a different time. So instead, we decided, okay, well, it's DNA then. So it's alien DNA instead of dimensional shifts. But, you know, the only hero who survived all of the kind of development that took 2 years is Accelerate. He was in the first pitch and he was in the final lineup.
That's fantastic, man. Now, you mentioned, obviously, your guys work at Marvel, and you guys had a healthy run on the X-Men. Am I right? I saw Heidi McDonald interview Joe recently, and she said, and I'm sorry.
Good Joe or Evil Joe?
Evil Joe.
Okay. I would say that as a joke, and everybody knows exactly.
Okay, so Joe Kelly or Joe Casey, of course. Yes, I'm assuming. But yes, it was Casey. And he said that they're printing an omnibus of the X-Men run. And were you part of that run? Are you in that omnibus as well?
I know nothing about that. They reprinted Joe Kelly and I did the books at the same time. That's where we met, actually. I had worked my way up through comics for a decade plus and, you know, did my Alpha Flight script, turned it in, and they're like, we want to put you on the X-Men. I'm like, no, I'm good. Because I'd already agreed to do Wolverine. And then Joe Kelly graduates and gets X-Men. I'm like, what? This guy is an asshole. What are we talking about? He didn't have to work for this. He debuts in the top spot. What are we talking about here? So I was just instantly, I hated him. And I was like, I can't wait to meet this guy. And I'm going to hate him to his face. And I flew to New York for the story conference. And Joe was in a shared car with me to drive us to the place where they had the meeting. And he couldn't have been nicer. And I was like, damn it. Why can't he be awful? I want to hate this nice guy. And by the end of the ride, I was super car sick because I have to drive or I get car sick. And he was like taking care of me. And I'm like, and he's a nurse and he's kind. And he's like, oh, damn it. So now we're lifelong friends because he was just too nice the day I met him to hate. So we did those books at the same time. And it was not a good time to be working at Marvel is the shortest answer to that. They were bankrupt. Though that was the first comic I ever bought myself was X-Men 114.
Awesome.
And I was excited to do it. It was the wrong time to do it. Like Joe and I did all this world building. We had this great story to tell. They all approved it. And then the company financially took a left turn and they're like, get rid of all that shit. You got to just put Gambit back in the book. You got to do this. Which they can do. That is their right to do.
Oh,
they own the company. They own the characters.
Yeah.
If you're the thing that's making money, they're going to do stuff to it. But it was really disheartening to do. The stories we could have told were a lot better than the stories we had to tell. And they rewrote everything we did. Just constant piles of dialogue that, you know, A, too much dialogue. But B, I just said to the editors, I was like, look, you can call me at 12 in the morning. You can call me at 2 in the morning. You can give me a 1 hour deadline. I want the words in the comic to be the words I write, not words I'm reading and going, I would never say that. This character wouldn't talk that way, you know, whatever. And we just, neither Joe or I could ever get them to do that. And we kept saying, we're going to walk if we can't have the words be our words. And they just never were. And we walked. So we stayed about a year and a half. There were good moments. I worked with Chris Pacello, which was lovely. I worked with Joe, which I still work with Joe. Duncan and Joe were also at those X-Men story conferences. That's why there's kind of this configuration Man of Action.
Sure.
We gravitated to each other's ideas and thought we could work. We're not alike, but we could work together. And so a lot of good came of it. And people love those runs. I used to go, you shouldn't because I was wrong. But, you know, wah, wah, wah for me. If people like them, I love that they like them. I wish they could have read them as I wrote them. And I wish they could have read the stuff Joe and I had in mind. But I'm happy people love them if they love them.
There's a different regime now in Marvel. Hell, there's been two or three since that time. Are you friendly with Marvel? Or are you? Do you ever pitch? Do they ever come to you?
Oh, they never come to me. You know, not a surprise really. But I don't pitch because Image will. If I go, hey Image, I want to put out a book of essays. Eric Stevenson will go. We'll do it. If I go, I want to put out Camp Midnight, a kid's book. We'll do it. I want to put out The Red Diary, super experimental, we'll do it. So I've not had any reason to go back there and do anything. And I always was like, oh, I wish I could have done my Daredevil story. But you know what? Frank Miller's Daredevil story I reread in the pandemic, it's good enough. Brian Bendis's I reread in the pandemic, it's good enough. I don't need to do one. Those are good. That's good. Well,
and I get that, man, because truly you did. You had, again, you've described a difficult situation at Marvel, but certainly at DC, you had a lot of great stuff. And I mean, really, that's why I kind of felt like you guys, all the four of you, really were like, you know, the Rat Race is fine. Tell you what, we're going to make our own stuff. See you later.
And it's been great. You know, I think if somebody came to us and said, do Marvel Knights somewhere, you know, where it's like Joe Quesada getting a little fiefdom of characters that they world build, because that's what our company does. Man of Action is a world build company.
Yeah.
They come to us and they go, like, Sonic came to us. They're like, we want to do a new Sonic show. We're like, we are going to build you a completely new world for Sonic to be in.
I didn't know that. That's great. I didn't know
you'd get good at Netflix right now. You can watch it. It's
very cool.
Drops out and the second drop, I don't know when it comes out.
Oh, that's great, man. Shame on me. I didn't realize. Yeah,
it's all good. It's all good. But that's what we do. So I think if we went back in a big way to mainstream comics, that would be what would be appealing, because that's what we do now. But otherwise, I'd rather read the cool ideas other people have and work in my weird ways and give people the weird stuff that I'm more inclined to do.
You had the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon, and you had the Avengers cartoon as well that you guys did. And especially now that you mentioned that you got the Sonic show at Netflix and everything, is there a big difference dealing with a streaming network versus an over-the-air network?
There were some big differences, but, you know, so when Netflix started and we would go pitch shows to them, it was like three people and they would just go yes, no, and that was it. And over time, Netflix has gotten much bigger, and now there's a bunch of people, and then they'll hire people and they'll lay people off, and they'll hire people and they'll lay people off. And it developmentally wise, like when you're pitching new material to them or pitching existing franchises in new configurations or whatever, it's gotten a bit more like what the networks were. But the networks, like Cartoon Network, not really a network at this point. You know, it's a piece of HBO Max. Well, now just Max.
I'm happy. Yeah,
but it's not really a studio. It's not a functioning studio. That stuff's now all made through a centralized body at Warner Brothers / Max. And then they go, well, that's a Cartoon Network show. So the kind of old models aren't there. And where they are, it's just kind of a new configuration. Most of the people at Netflix or Apple or Amazon or wherever, they're all people we knew from other places that were more traditional cable networks or broadcast networks. So that's how they came up. That's what they're more used to. There's some differences, but it's, you know, different place, same nice people.
Good.
You know, orders have gotten shorter. We used to do a ton more episodes. Now you do fewer. So they have to be even better. I prefer that. I'd rather just think of a complete story and move on to the next one. So that's good with me. But it's very different than doing serialized. You know, when we were doing Spider-Man, we were doing 26 at a clip. And most streaming things right now are 8 episodes at a clip.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you, man. And that's the thing. I honestly, and I think other people have been saying this and wondering as well, what the future is for the over the air or over cable networks, given not only the strength of streaming as far as views, but also, people time shift and everything. So you wonder when, they're going to, you know, that change is going to happen, and that we really are going to have to like buy 10 different streamers to really get current programming or whatever.
Yeah. And this is also being sorted out. I mean, there are so many mergers and consolidations and content being canceled, and, you know, what it's a very disruptive time. That's why the strike is also interesting in this kind of context. Yes. But The big difference, I think, is this idea of watching it all. You know, it used to be that you were trying to hook people into watching a little bit of something and then a bunch of commercials, then a little bit of something and a bunch of commercials. And you wanted to keep them doing that for half a year. And then there'd be another half a year. And then there was the summer where you'd watch, people in bikinis jump over trampoline, like, but with the idea of watching these commercials. And streaming said, no commercials, just watch the thing. The thing is the thing. Which was great if you're a content creator. And then over time, of course, a very short period of time, they said, but how do we pay for all this? It's costing billions and there's no commercials. So now you've got all these streamers going, well, here's some commercial tiers that you can do to pay for that stuff because it costs billions. Well, no surprise, that's how it was on network TV. So network became cable, cable became streamers, and streamers are becoming networks. And it's like, you know, where did we get? We got some great TV out of it is where we got.
I hear you, man. And in fact, here back in the comments, Mike Jones says, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon was amazing for me. The best of those characters, certainly in the animated realm. And yeah, what a wonderful show. Absolutely.
Well, so these are two different shows. So Earth's Mightiest Heroes is the one that preceded us. And we also worked on that a little bit. The general reason people love Earth's Mightiest Heroes is because it's like the Avengers comic books we grew up with if we're a certain age.
Yeah.
So we did the last four episodes of that series. Jeff Loeb brought us in to do those when he kind of took over Marvel Animation. And we were like, hell yeah, we can do some of our favorite Avengers stories. So that was fun. But then that show ended and the new Avengers was starting. And, you know, the job with all animated shows is you've got to make a show for kids. Like, you want a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid to fall in love with Spider-Man, to fall in love with the Avengers, to fall in love with Ben 10.
Sure.
And if you've done your job right, they stay with it and they become 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Or if you've done your job right, somebody who's like, I love the Avengers comics when I was, you know, 12. Now I'm 40. I love this cartoon because it reminds me of those comics. The problem is, like, the 40-year-olds who like Avengers cartoon, most of the time, a six-year-old doesn't like that because the things that are triggering, not triggering in a bad way, but that are getting you excited about that are not there in the mind of a kid. So every once in a while, if you do one of those kind of more nostalgic shows, like some of the Batman cartoons deal more with the mythos, some deal less, you've got to create a new show to go, hey, kids, I want you to fall in love with Batman too. Because they're not going to fall in love with the comics. The comics are $4 a pop. They have gunshots to the head. You know, it's like, you need a Batman that speaks to a kid. You need a Spider-Man that speaks to a kid. And so Joe Quesada was fully aware of what Spider-Man was and what the previous series of that had been. And same with the Avengers. And he was in our rooms and he was like, let go of that. You know, think about what is Spider-Man and make us a show that a kid will love, which is how Man of Action works anyway. We always start with what is the essence of something. If you just tell me Spider-Man, what do I think of? Before we do any research, before we look at anybody else's shows, what is it? What makes Spider-Man Spider-Man? What does it have to register? And we jot all that. Then we go, what did people do? What have other shows done? What are they? Because we don't want to do that. You don't need to do that again. There was Earth's Mightiest Heroes. It covered all the cool Roy Thomas, Stan Lee, whatever, Avengers stories. You don't need to do it again. It's there. It will exist forever. Hopefully, though they're pulling stuff off of streaming now, but hopefully it exists forever. And you can just go back to that version. So you've got to make a new version that a kid goes, this is my Spider-Man. I now love Spider-Man. And you know what? I love it so much, I'm going to look at the previous animated show and all those comics that are on all those omnibus volumes and whatever. And as they mature, they look through all this other version, all this extra Spider-Man. The movies are doing a great job of that. They're for parents. They're for kids. They're for whatever. And that's what kind of a franchise experience is about. So I feel you, Mike Jones. I loved Earth's Mightiest Heroes too. If Avengers Assemble didn't grab you, that's okay. Your show was Earth's Mightiest Heroes, and Assemble was for kids younger than you and me.
I hear you, man. You know, Liefeld and I were just talking about this last night. And again, you and I are pretty much the same age. I my entry to Marvel was the 67 Ralph Bashke Spider-Man TV series and those Marvel Superheroes cartoons.
Yeah,
as crudely animated as they were. You know, we were getting Kirby Images and then the great artists of the 60s. And yeah, and it wasn't until I started seeing the Treasury Edition comics of Marvel, the Fantastic Four, the Avengers were ones right off the bat that I remember first reading. And that's when I really got into the Marvel Universe. But you're absolutely right, man. I mean, it's that is kind of the hard thing. And I know that that was the problem with a couple DC animated projects like the Green Lantern TV series, which all of us old farts loved. And then they're like, yeah, but they're not selling toys to the Y7s. And that's why we made this show.
Well, and Ben 10 sold a lot of toys and thank goodness.
Indeed.
But to be fair, we don't, even though that we know what the toy possibilities of that are, we knew when we made it up what they were. But that show has got to speak to a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid. And so the show is, Ben 10 is always about identification. Like, a kid wishes they were taller. They wishes they were faster. They wish they could fly. They wish fulfillment because they feel like they're inferior to the forces around them. So the supervillain becomes a stand-in for a bully or for an older kid or for a taller kid or a faster kid or whatever. And I have the means to become that. But without training, I am not good at that. And so it turns out that what I need is not that watch or that power. you know, I need knowledge. I need experience. Gwen does all the same shit Ben does, but she doesn't have a watch and she seems to survive just fine. That's lost on Ben, right? So you got to build the thing. And then if it sells toys, that'll keep it alive longer. But if the show does not speak to a kid who's 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, what they're going through, what matters to them, then it doesn't work. So like I was just at a wedding rolling around in the grass when I should have been paying attention with a friend's kid, seeing what she was into. What did she run to? How did she play? What was she doing? You know, like I got to keep my kid brain learning all the time because it evolves over time. You know, I have my own kids now and I'm like, what are you watching? What's that video game playing? We do a lot of video games at Man of Action.
Indeed.
And I rarely played video games. Now I just sit 24 hours a day with my son and I'm like, wait, go back. Show me that cutscene again. Why do you like that? Who are you playing as? What mods did you make to that costume? Like, I've got to get in his head to do a good job of doing the work because it's not what I like. You know, it's not what I would do. If I do a video game, it would be like boring people talking about the 1930s or whatever. But that's not it. Like, that's not my job. My job is to make a thing that he will play and love and identify with.
That's brilliant, man. You know, Mike wanted to know if you guys are possibly doing some more video game writing, and he respects non-disclosure.
Yes, so. Video games take a long time, and they have a lot of NDAs. So yes is the answer. I can't tell you anything about the ones we're working on. There are several. I can tell you that we teamed up with a company called Creation Station. That's whose wedding I was at. Shout out to Dylan, newly married, and Omar, whose kid I was playing with. All of us with Man of Action, them have been working with. I got to get my company names right, so I don't. I have so many game companies right now that I'm like, if I slip up and say the wrong, then I will have violated the NDA. Let's just say the Hello Neighbor people. I know their company name, but now I'm not going to say it out of phobia. And we're doing an animated series that's on YouTube for Hello Neighbor, which is a video game. And we're doing a world build outside of that to go, what more than the game exists and what story do we tell? And so that's been really fascinating because, you know, we're dealing directly with the people who make the game and they're going, here's what we do. Here's what we don't do. Here's what we like about your show. Here's what we don't like. And it's you were talking about the difference between networks and streamers. This show is on YouTube because the people who are paying for the show are the people who own the property making their own show. So there's no in between, which is fascinating because I've become like we can't do that. Like there's nobody telling us not to do stuff. And I'm going, oh my gosh, that could get us in trouble. Or, oh my gosh, that seems, you know, dangerous. And it's fascinating because I'm the person who's always complaining about that person when we're working for like a bigger entity. And now I am that person. So I guess there needs to be that person all the time. But that's on YouTube. I think they put up 2 episodes as just a teaser, but there's going to be a lot of episodes. I can't say when. Sometimes.
That's excellent. No, Steve, truly, this has been such an education. And I really appreciate you getting that granular in terms of the differences and what you're doing in it. And it's amazing that there are so many differences regarding animation and the differences that you impose on your comics. And then making them as different as they are.
But the similarity, if anybody's an aspiring writer, my similarity that I would say for all of this is if I do a Ben 10, if I do a weirdo graphic novel with an experimental form, if I do Sandman Mystery Theater, if I do Get Naked, if I do whatever I do, my Daredevil story at some point, it needs to be something that matters to me. I've got to give you something. You're paying for my work. I've got to go, here's what I have to tell you about Superman. And when I did It's a Bird, I was like, I don't like Superman, and here's why. And here's why I think I'm wrong. Like, that's what that book is. It's going, if you don't like superheroes, I get you. I didn't either. But here's why Superman trumps whatever we're talking about. I give you something for your time, for your money. And I think that my worst work is where I go, I want to tell a really fun fill-in-the-blank story with this fill-in-the-blank villain that I always liked when I was a kid. That stuff is, there's nothing there. You know, it's a photocopy of a photocopy. It doesn't have anything to do with me. If I did a Daredevil story, you know, I'm not blind. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a New Yorker. I don't need to do that story, which Frank and Brian covered all that stuff. I mean, they're not that stuff either. So they're just better than me, but whatever. But I've got to dig down and go, what do I know about justice? Like, I do know some stuff about justice. And I feel that I understand what I think is unjust in this world and what I think needs to be righted. That's the Daredevil story I need to tell. Something that matters to me in that granular, hyper-personal way. And then I've got to figure out, and what if I was blind? And what if I was a lawyer? And what if I was a superhero? And put that over it. And I think too much stuff that I read a lot of comics, I watch a lot of cartoons, especially now that I have kids. And there's a lot of really well-made stuff where I go, but what is it about? Like, what did you give me or my kid or whoever? And I don't have an answer. So I try not to do that.
Interesting. I hear you, man. You know, back in the day, when I was covering boxing regularly, my old editor, Bert Sugar of Boxing Illustrated, given that we were, you know, I'm here in Illinois, and he's like, you got to write a Red Grange biography. Man, he goes, you know, University of Illinois would pay for that right away. Red Grange was a great college football player for Illinois back in the 20s. I'm saying this for the younger people. And I'm like, I'm not interested. He's like, that's money on the table. I'm like, just like you said, I'm like, yeah, but I don't give a shit about Red Grange. I absolutely respect him and what he accomplished. But if it doesn't speak to you, you can't do it. So, no, I hear you, man. I absolutely hear you. Jesus.
Yeah, and then like Big Hero 6, which Duncan and I made up at Marvel.
Yes, it did.
You know, Disney did even better. Like they knew more things about these things we made up. It's like people are like, do you like that? I'm like, do I like it? Like it's touching. It's beautiful. It's funny. It's whatever. Like stuff can be done with stuff. They just found a really personal story to tell. I don't know whose person it was. And some of it was in there, like a hero in the comics lost his dad. They changed that to a brother. Well, there's a different dimension if it's your brother. That's closer in age range. You know, in ours, he built the battle suit version of his dead father to be both his mentor and his protector. So in the Disney version, it's his protector, but they made him squishy, you know, lovable, huggable, touchable. Like these things make it even better. So I love franchise work. You can add to stuff. You can make it stronger. But I think a lot of times people are just not fan service. It's like self fan service where you're like, I love this so much. I want to write my own or draw my own or whatever. And you've got to make it your own. It can't just be a thing you remember fondly, or it'll just be a copy of a thing you remember fondly.
Amen, man. No, I think that's a great writer's tip. And I think that's a great place for us to stop. And I will thank Liesl and your kids for allowing us to talk as long as we have. But
I was trying to write out to their bedtime, and now I got to go back and exist with my family. No, I'm happy to.
I'm sure you are. That's seriously, man, and that's really great that you adopted the kids, especially older kids, because that's tough. And I'm really glad. I hope
we are old ourselves, so we just kept back dating. Like, well, now we need kids who are 7 and 12. Now we need kids who are 9 and 13. Now we need, and we just got so old that it was 9 and 16 that we needed.
Well, that's one.
Now they're 12 and 19. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's happening?
Oh man. Oh God. Well, that's really tough because the 12-year-old is entering the teen years, and
she is on a tear right now. On a tear. She's lovely and fantastic, but she's 12.
Well, she was scared of me. You were telling me that she saw me in black and she thought I was very creepy.
I was showing her some of your other episodes. She's like, he needs a light. He's creepy. That is creepy. That's
worse. I understand. No, I'm almost a disembodied head. I can appreciate that. If you squint, you can see that I'm wearing a shirt. Thank God.
All right. Tell me how much I owe you for anybody who couldn't contribute. Oh, everybody who did, thank you. And everybody who didn't, thank you anyway.
Great questions. And you're very kind, Steve. I genuinely appreciate it. And everybody, thanks a lot. You had great questions. And thank you for watching. And Steve, please come back when either the Dynamite announcement becomes real or whatever your next thing is. I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
and nice so to good. See everybody. Oh, and somebody asked about Primal Force. It's never time to bring back Primal Force, according to DC. But thanks for asking, Stephen.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And was Primal Force the one that came out of Zero Hour?
Yes.
Okay. I don't remember that story. Well,
next time we'll talk
good.
About it.
Good. You're thinking. That's excellent, man. No, I'm so glad we finally did this. It exceeded expectations, and I love where the conversation went, and you gave us a lot to think about. So thanks a lot.
You had low expectations. See you next time.
Absolutely, man. Steve Siegel, everybody. Tomorrow night, it's my nerd passion of Star Trek coming through. We're a week away from season two of the Pike show, Strange New Worlds. And me and the guys that normally review shows and stuff will be discussing season one with a newbie who just watched season one through the library. I know that right now they're running season one on YouTube for free for the rest of the month. But in anticipation of season two, we'll review season one. So that's happening Thursday. Friday, I'm talking to Andy Parks. Andy's got a new adaptation of one of his stories is on Netflix as well. We're going to be talking about that. So that's
I said hello. I haven't seen him in a decade or more.
I absolutely will. No, that'll be great, man. Thanks, everybody, for watching. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy. Stay healthy.